I'm only here so I don't get fined. I think the Seahawks brought their weather with them. So there's kind of a big sporting event today, right? And we all know what that is, the Phoenix Open. I'm glad you're able to find it here. The fog was supposed to already be gone, but there, here it is. Crazy. It's like we're living somewhere else right now, but it's good to be here. I'm glad you guys are here. I'm glad we're here to worship Jesus. And I just want to start off by telling a story I heard from a pastor friend who lives in Dallas area. He's a runner. He'd go running, and he told a story once about how he would where he would run by his house. He would always end up at this like AM PM kind of market about a quarter mile from his house. We'd stop there, buy Gatorade, drink it, stretch, and then use that last quarter mile walk home as his cool down. But it was right on the intersection of two really busy kind of like highways kind of thing. So it was always packed in the mornings when he would run. There'd just be cars backed up both ways. And he ran up one morning, went in, got his Gatorade. He's standing out there, and another guy comes running up, and he's been running with this big Rottweiler dog, like a huge dog. Looked like he was on steroids, you know, and it was like crazy dog. And he takes the leash and he ties it to this bench. And then he goes in. Now the bench is bolted into the ground, kind of rusted. A couple of the bolts aren't there anymore, but still a couple of rusted bolts out. And this guy goes inside. And while he's standing there, he watches as this feral cat comes running out of the alleyway and runs right by this dog. And the dog does the righteous and true thing. He goes after the evil cat. And so he takes off like a good dog should. And as he takes off, you know, the leash pulls tight. And instead of yanking the dog back and stopping him, he is so powerful that it rips the other bolts out of the ground and he starts dragging the bench behind him. And so this pastor's there watching this, and he chases after the cat. And the cat, there's no trees around, no place for him to jump onto something. So the cat decides to use evasive maneuvers and darts right in and out of the cars that are not moving in the traffic. The dog chases after him, and he watches as this dog runs right in, and then smash, the bench goes right into the headlight of a Mercedes. Then he turns, and every time he zigzags between cars, this bench just comes falling behind, just whack, you know, right up against a BMW. Then he said it hit this Escalade. Then it ran into a 97 Saturn, which actually increased its value, but it just kept going. And he watched it before, by the time they got the dog calmed down and were able to unleash the bench from him, it had hit about 20 cars. And he said it had to have done at least $20,000 worth of damage. And what's crazy is the reason I always remember that story is it reminds me of what we do in our lives all the time in regards to the hurts that have happened to us and the hurts that has happened through us. When we hold on to those things, when we don't seek amends and forgiveness, and especially when we keep ourselves leashed to unforgiveness, when we have things that people did and we hold on to it and we can't let go, we drag these through our lives. And no matter what we're chasing after, no matter how fast we run, no matter how hard we turn, no matter what we're chasing in life, this unforgiveness just follows behind us, leashed to us, just bam, causing collateral damage in our relationships everywhere we go. That's one of the reasons the divorce rate increases in multiple marriages. Because if we don't learn that we need to be able to let go and have forgiveness for the hurts and seek amends for the hurts we've done, if we don't make the relational choice in our life, the relationship choice, we just carry it behind us and we bring it everywhere we go. We reap damage. And we've been in this series, Hurts, Habits, and Hangups. We've been unpackaging the teachings from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, the section called the Beatitudes, where he's describing what the kingdom looks like. This is what a healthy follower of Jesus, what the world should be like for them. And as he looks at it, and we've been unpackaging it, we've been talking about different choices we can make to walk into health. And today's choice is one of the most critical ones because we will drag these things around through our lives and they will cause damage in everywhere we go and we might not even realize it. So today I want to talk about the relational choice, the relationship choice. And there are some notes in the back of the chairs I have writing on if you'd like to like see what we're actually saying here. The relationship choice is simply this. It says, I evaluate all of my relationships. I offer forgiveness to those who have hurt me, and I make amends for the harm I've done to others, except when to do so would harm them or others. So in other words, it's a simple, you gotta unleash the bench. You have to unleash yourself from unforgiveness in your life. Seek forgiveness and closure for the things that you have done, and let go of the hurt that's happened to you. But like it says in the choice, I wanna explain a couple things before I dive in, because as I often say, I don't want you to hear what I'm not saying. So let me explain a couple of things. First, to seek forgiveness, to let things go, and to go seek amends does not automatically mean you go track down every person that's ever hurt you or you've ever hurt in your life. Matter of fact, that's the part about if it would hurt others, if it would harm, if it would cause more harm to physically go try to do this, you might just have to do this between you and God in your own heart. So I'm not saying to go run after everything that ever happened and little Timmy that you poked him in the eye when he was in third grade. You know, that's not what I'm saying. The second thing you got to understand is when you hear this idea of forgiveness and unleashing from unforgiveness, and you all have the card you got handed, you opened it up and looked at it, you know where I'm going to end this sermon at. I'm going to challenge you to unleash today. I'm going to challenge you to write some names in there. And some of you are already like, no way. There is no way I'm going to forgive that person because they haven't changed. They haven't repented. They haven't done anything. Can I just help you understand? There is a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. You think that when we say to forgive someone, that means reconcile, go right back into a relationship, or let a relationship stay the way it is. Or, you know, the problem is that's where codependency comes from. You see, what we mean, it takes one to forgive. It takes two to reconcile. See, forgiveness is unhooking yourself from the bitterness, unhooking yourself from the resentment. If I'm going to forgive someone, even if they didn't ask for it, you can do that. It only takes one person to offer forgiveness. What you're not doing, you're not letting them off the hook, so to speak. See, a lot of times you're like, I can't write that name now. I can't do it because they never change. So you're telling me I got to let them off the hook? Off the hook for what? You holding a bitter resentment for them, taking that anger against them and calling it your precious. My precious. What is that doing to them? See, what I'm going to challenge us to do today is forgiveness is unhooking you. It's letting you off the hook. Not them. See, if you think that to forgive someone means to let it go right back to where it was, that's codependency. You've heard the name, you know, we've talked codependency all of the time. I'm codependent. You're codependent. That's codependent. And I don't think anyone actually knows what that word means. You want to know what it means? Two words. Write it down. I'll define codependency for you. People-pleasing. People-pleasing. So if you are a codependent person, and I start talking about let's unleash ourselves from unforgiveness, and I challenge you to let someone go, what you think I might be saying is, in that relationship that's currently going on and there's bad things happening, I need to forgive him. So that means even though there's horrible things happening, there's been abuse, there's been betrayal of trust, that you can think that on what I'm saying is say, okay, forgive and forget, I forgive you, and let's go right back to where we were and act like nothing's changed. That's not what I'm saying. Matter of fact, some of the people in this room, the codependency, the way it works the other way around is you will manipulate that in someone's life. For example, you're married. You've had a struggle. Let me just give an example. Say your struggle is alcohol. And you've asked for forgiveness, and you've been forgiven a million times, but you're still struggling, but now you say, okay, I forgive you, but you don't trust the person yet. You know, you've been in a program, you've gone through something, you're trying to not drink, and all of a sudden, your spouse, whether, you know, guy, girl, comes to you and says, hey, some coworkers, there's this conference, we're going to go to Vegas, and I want to go. And I go, who else is going? Well, my friends, and you know that all the coworkers drink. And you as the spouse are not comfortable with that because this person's only been trying to not drink too much for a month. And you say, no, you can't go. What does the person usually say? I thought you forgave me. Yeah, I forgave you. But just because I forgave you doesn't mean I trust you to go to Vegas with a bunch of drinking buddies and not drink. See, we will manipulate. That's what codependency is. You're saying forgiveness. You equate forgiveness to reconciliation. You equate forgiveness to it's okay, let's go back to the status quo. You can forgive someone and then say, but we have to have a plan to rebuild trust. You can have boundaries. What I'm talking about is forgiveness is holding on and always holding against them and saying, I'm going to, you know what, you got to dance, monkey. You got to jump through these hoops. And I am not going to, I'm not going to forgive you until I trust you. I'm not going to let go of this until you prove yourself to me. And I'm telling you, the Bible's very clear, that will kill you. The phrase that they like to say in the recovery world and stuff is to hold on to bitterness and resentment is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And some of us are drinking poison by the gallon. And I had to preface this because so many times when I say this, the people that really need to listen are like, you don't know my situation. You don't know what happened. It doesn't matter. Because I'm doing this and sharing this for you. In other words, to unleash from unforgiveness, what we got to do is you come to the table and you put forgiveness out there. You release it. You do what Paul said, is as far as is up to you, be at peace with all people. Whether or not the other person comes to the other side of the table or not. Because when you do that, you've now unhooked the leash. And whether they ever return, whether there's reconciliation or not, I can now move on in my life and not drag that pain and that bitterness through every other relationship I'm ever going to have. Does that make sense? Awesome. Well, where do we get this from? Matthew chapter 5. Jesus has been teaching. The Beatitudes we looked at the first few weeks were ones about emptiness, and now we've transitioned when we hunger and thirst for righteousness or right relatedness to God. He said, here's the things we'll be filled with. And the first thing was a pure heart. And what I explained pure heart was it wasn't being perfect. It was, I want what God wants. So in my life, when I'm confronted with the fact that I went after something that God wouldn't want, I'm constantly going to be confronted with this in my life. I'm going to come to a situation that what I went after and what I want is not what God's word wants. It's not what God says. And I just have to decide, am I going to repent and turn from my way and surrender to God? That's a pure heart. King David, a man after God's own heart, he did a lot of stupid things, but when he was confronted, he would repent and turn. That's what it means to have a pure heart. You're never going to be able to walk with God. You're never going to walk in healthy relationships if you live as a Christian that is fighting with God all the time. And you're sitting there saying, God, I love you. I love that you died for me. But these two things you say, I'm never going to obey you on them. Your life will never work. You won't have the power of God's grace in your life if you're going to do that all the time. It doesn't mean you won't relapse. It doesn't mean we don't make mistakes. It doesn't mean we go backwards. But my heart needs to be one that says, in my heart of hearts, I just want what God wants from me, even if I'm wrestling with it. Then the next two are the ones we're looking at today. These other two things we're supposed to be filled with, and they all go together. It's mercy. Oh. And peacemaking. Verse 7. God blesses those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And verse 9, God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called children of God. So he talks about hungering, thirsting for righteousness. And then he describes three attributes of what that right relatedness with God looks like. When you have a right relationship with God, what does it look like in your life? You have the purity, the passion, the single-minded focus. And you are a merciful peacemaker. It means you'll go there and you'll have mercy. Like, here's the definition for mercy here, if you want to understand. Mercy is when you see a distress, you have a heart of pity, and you have an effort to help in spite of reason for enmity. Reason for enmity means I have a reason to want you to suffer because you've actually hurt me, and now you're struggling. Why would I help you out? See, there has to be the reason for enmity for it to be mercy. Did you know that? If you just see a distress, have a heart of pity, and an effort to help, that's compassion. Mercy is when you do that for the person that has offended you. It's when, that's what mercy is. Mercy is, so Jesus says, blessed are the merciful. People that will actually have pity, see this distress, and reach out and let things go. with people they have reasons to be offended by. And then peacemaking is linked right with it. It's this idea that you don't look for war. You look to be a person that makes things right between people and God. You want to make things right between your relationships with people. I look to make it right. And ultimately, I also want to help make things right between you and God. I want to be a peacemaker. In other words, when I go into relationships that I struggle with, I don't look to make war. You look to make peace. Now, here's the other thing when it comes to codependency. If you are a codependent, what you probably heard me just say is we're supposed to be peace achievers. A peace achieving is not peacemaking. Paul said, like I already said, as far as it's up to you, be at peace with all people. It means as far as it's up to you, meaning you can do everything you're supposed to do, and the other person might leave it sitting on the table. That's okay. That's peacemaking. I did my part. Peace achieving is I will achieve peace at all costs. And if you're a codependent, you hear peacemaking is I need to forgive, I need to have mercy, and I need to go, thank you, sir, may I have another, and go right back into the same relationship. Let them move back in just because they said they're sorry. No boundaries, no issues, no counseling, no expectation. I just am supposed to make everything work at all costs to make sure there's peace. That's a codependence definition. And if that's what you thought I said, you need to go to CR. And you need to go into the codependency subgroup and talk about that, because that's not what I'm saying. But if you think about it, of all the things when God said, this is what right relatedness will look like in the life of someone who knows me, he uses purity, mercy, and peacemaking. That's interesting. Why did he pick those? Of all the things to describe right relatedness, why would he describe someone with a single-minded devotion to God's will who would be merciful and make peace between people and God? Does that sound like somebody we know? Does that sound like someone right here, maybe the guy teaching this? He just described Jesus. Jesus is the merciful peacemaker who came to do the Father's will no matter what it cost him. And he did it perfectly. And he brought mercy because we were the offenders against him, yet he died for us to bring peace between us and God and give us the ability to have peace between each other. So in other words, all he's saying is right relatedness to Jesus is you're going to start looking like Jesus. That's what he's talking about. So what does this mean? How does this work in my unleashing unforgiveness in my life? Let me give you an example, because I told you there was no video testimony. I don't have someone out here today. I'm going to use my story in this one. My story has the, oh, wow, but that's not even the heart of it. It gets to something that's much more common and really the deeper issue that I hope you can see in your own life by hearing my story. And to understand mercy and peacemaking, God put someone in my life that was a physical, tangible Jesus to me that helped me understand that the idea of why I want to go after this, why would I want to have that single-minded focus on what God wants, is because he was the merciful peacemaker. I see how much he loved me. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit and know that your life is unmanageable. Know that you're out of control. Know that we are far from God, yet he died for me. He loved me that much. And instead of bringing me condemnation, instead of heaping shame, instead of punishing me, he loved me anyways. And because of that love, I can now go follow him, not for his love, but from his love. And that empowers us. Why did that happen in my own life? And the Jesus to me was my wife. I've shared openly, and I had her up here a number of years ago, but about 13 years ago, when I was getting ready to start this church, I started to wrestle with one of the demons I have. I'm going to share more details at the CR a week from Friday if you want to come hear the whole story. If this is relates to you, be there. But let me give you like a summary of it. Is in my life, I've discovered there are unhealthy habits I'll run after. When we talk about habits, every habit, anything we get addicted to, you know what addiction is? It's an unhealthy coping mechanism that is now controlling your life. It's something you ran to for comfort, and now it's controlling you. You ran to it because you're hurting. There's something deeper going on. So alcoholism, sex addiction, food issues, all of those things, those are not the problem. Those are the symptoms. Now, they become a problem in and of themselves, but they're symptoms. And if you don't get to the deeper issue, I don't care how many times you conquer one addiction, you'll go find something else or you'll go back to it if you don't get to the heart of it. Well, I grew up, didn't become a Christian until I was in high school, and one of my ladders into hell and my struggles is with lust. I'm a guy, I'm wired like a guy, this is the way we are, and I struggled with it. I battled. After I became a Christian, I realized, you know what, this is the way I view things. If you look at stuff, I started to understand that it distorts your view of sexuality. It distorts your ability to be intimate with the person you're married to. And I started to learn this stuff, so I've always wrestled with it. Well, I got married, had some kids, we're planting the church, a ton of stress in my life, and stress would make me want to run to my unhealthy places. And I had an office in my house, my wife would be out a lot, and I was left alone, and I started getting pretty inappropriate on the computer. And it wasn't really just porn, it was more like YouTube, Google Images. I'm afraid I just gave some people some ideas, sorry. And here's what's crazy. So I started to have this, it started to control me. I started to retreat into this world. I didn't want my wife to know. I knew God knew. And so you'd go, you'd have you'd spend time doing this, and then you'd feel great shame. Guys, and a lot of you women too, you understand what I'm saying. And then you say, you know what, that was bad. I don't want to do it anymore. You know, it's like, I'm going to stop. I'm just going to. Never again. God, I'm sorry. I'm not going to do this anymore. And you white knuckle it, and it just doesn't work. And you know what's crazy to me right now as I'm sharing this is we live in a weird world that's like kind of two-faced. Tries to speak out of both ends of its mouth. So many people sit there, well, that's normal. Pornography, the reason you shouldn't struggle and beat yourself up is it's okay. Everyone does it, especially guys. Why would you fight? And a lot of you guys are sitting out here, and every time I talk about this issue and you want to deal with it, you're like, I don't really need to deal with it. It's not that big of a deal. You know what? It's better than actually cheating on my wife. And you know what? The reality is no. Actually having an affair complicates things more, but it's no better for you. It distorts your view of sex. You retreat into a selfish world. When you're in a world of your own making when it comes to sexuality, especially with pornography and stuff, is you've created a world that's all about you. And God created sex to be a place that's all about us. Sex should be a part of a giving relationship, not just a receiving relationship. And when you look at it that way, you distort it and you become selfish. And to be honest, you become really bad at it. And it distorts you in ways you don't even know. And so I got pulled into this, and I would say I'm going to deal with it. I'm sorry, God. And I'd start and I get sucked back in. And you know what? And then you're sitting there thinking you don't think it's a problem, but it is. Every statistic on the planet proves that it distorts us. And if you don't want to admit it's not a problem, then why don't you want to tell your spouse that you do it? If you think it's no problem, then go talk to him and say, I'm doing it. I don't think it's a problem. And after your throat recovers, or other sensitive body parts, come back and talk to me about how it's not a problem. The other weird dichotomy with me even sharing this, when I shared it years ago with my wife up here, is we live in a world that people want to say it's not really a big deal, everyone does it, but the second a pastor shares about it, everyone's repulsed. That's why pastors don't want to share. You say it's not a problem, yet you're like, ugh, you're a pastor? You can't. What's his problem? How dare him be just like me? It's a struggle. It's an issue. It distorts us. And you know when I started to realize that I couldn't do it alone and it really distorted me is I knew it had changed. Within weeks it had changed my personality, subtle ways. Then it got not so subtle. Because when you want to go into your private little world to retreat and escape, you get very selfish. And then if someone pushes against that time, you get mad. And my wife would be out at her. She had a group she went to. And I looked for her that night. She'd get out there, and then I could be alone. And I'd put the kids to bed. They were small. I had two at the time. And my daughter was about 5 years old. And they kept getting up. She usually would stay in bed. I go, you need to go to bed because I just want to be left alone. And she kept getting up, and finally she came in. I was like, what are you doing up again? And I ripped her face off and told her to get back in bed, or I was going to spank her. I was like, I never talked like that to her. I ripped her, and as she walked down the hall, I heard her, and I hear her through her tears just say, I just wanted to say I love you. So you know what? You don't think it's a problem. You don't think it's an issue, guys. The Greek word, to be accurate, the Bible word puts it this way. You're full of it. You're a liar, and you know it. And you're afraid. And the reason I know it is I've been there. I've been there. And I know the first reaction. Some of you are so scared what I just said. You've had an issue. You've kept your private little world. It's been even longer than my issue was. And what you're saying to yourself right now is, okay, I'm not doing this ever again. And you're planning your white knuckle. You're just going to do it. And you're not going to take the healthy steps. And it's not going to work. So I got scared about that, and I didn't want to disqualify myself from being able to do what I love and was called to do is teach God's word. And I knew that if I went any further down this road, I was going to have to step aside. Because I wasn't going to be the guy on TV with a scandal. And I wasn't going to break my daughter's heart. So I had an accountability pastor friend that I finally started being honest with. See, some of us can hide in plain sight. You go to the groups, you have it, you can sit there. Going doesn't mean anything. Showing means something. And so I started on this journey, and I started to get some health. I got a book called Every Man's Battle, and I was going through that with my friend, and I was getting victory. I was like, okay, I felt the weight off, but I still hadn't said anything to my wife because I didn't want to hurt her feelings or whatever. And about 4 or 5 months, I'd been way far along. I'd been a good boy for a long time, and I feel like I was back on the right track. She saw the book sitting on my desk one day when I was out, and I came back and she'd been reading. She read almost the whole thing. She's a fast reader. And she's like, wow, I didn't even know guys thought like, this is the way you're really wired? The guys really are put together this way? She goes, yeah. I go, man, you guys are messed up. No, she didn't say that. She actually had empathy. She's like, I never even thought that this is the way a guy thinks. And then she put the book down, and I was starting to walk out. She goes, you don't have that struggle, though, do you? And I kind of mumbled, no, not right now. And I walked out. And I didn't want to talk about it because of shame. And I wanted to say no because I could have pulled a New England Patriots. Technically, I obeyed the rules. And I could have said, literally, no, I have not had that struggle for 4 or 5 months. But I knew that's not what she meant. She meant, do you wrestle with this issue in your life? And so I turned around and walked back in because I go, man, I've done some stupid things. But here's another way I know that this private world affects you, whether you realize it or not, is you lie to somebody. And I wasn't going to start lying to my wife. So I walked back in and I sat down and I explained to her the situation. Now, imagine hearing there's been this private world, there's been this. She felt all those emotions. It hurt. The biggest thing she said later on that hurt was not even the act of lust. She understood how guys are wired. It was the fact that I had a private world that she had no idea about. So then she wondered, what other private worlds are there? But in the moment, despite every reason to be upset and hurt, she was the merciful peacemaker. She didn't withdraw. She didn't say no. She didn't say, you know what? Well, great. Well, as soon as you get that fixed, I'll love you again. As soon as you go, well, you better get your, or she didn't throw things at me. She didn't. She looked at me and she said, well, what are we going to do about this? She said, we. She didn't say it's a he problem. It was a we problem because we were one flesh. We were married. And she said, I forgive you. I forgive you. And she showed me mercy. And she wanted to make peace. And all I can tell you is this. In that moment, when I felt so much shame and I expected her to reject me, she pulled me in. And she showed me Jesus. Now, I know there's a lot of people in this room that would not react like my wife did. I wouldn't expect you to. It might be different circumstances. Your spouse might not be that person you go have that great reveal with right away. You might need to get into a program and get somebody else, meet someone else safe, share with them, and they could help you figure out how do you reveal this stuff? How do you talk a spouse through this stuff? That first contact might not need to be your wife, but if you, or your husband, but if you could be like Carrie was, I'll just tell you from a man who experienced it, instead of experiencing a spouse that says, now you got a dance monkey and do all the right things and then I will forgive you, instead of doing it for forgiveness, I chose to go after this issue in my life with reckless abandon from forgiveness. And that's what Jesus calls us to do. You don't follow him for his forgiveness. You follow him from his forgiveness. The fact that he already loves you and he will not reject you, and that empowers you instead of fear and shame and guilt and you better or else, it pushes you forward to be like, I'd never want to fail this woman again. Now, I know a lot of you can't handle it, and the circumstances would be maybe that's not right. I have to kind of pre-qualify, because when Carrie and I shared this before, a lot of people, mainly guys, went to their wife and said, you know what, I've been having this problem for like 20 years and I've been lying to you the whole time. And then when their wife didn't act a certain way, like, why aren't you acting like Carrie? That was the dumbest thing you could ever say. If you say that, just duck, stop, drop, and roll out of the room. But if you could see it in you, you'll see change faster. I guarantee it. But my wife is awesome. And she's put together in a way, the way she loves God and trusts him and loves me. I get how that would be very difficult to be like that. But I understood forgiveness. I understand merciful peacemaking in such a better way. And you'd think once you get that you'd go and just never hold a resentment again, right? We should all be perfect once we realize how forgiving God is and people in our lives are. But that doesn't happen that way, because most of us, including me, go off and act like this guy does in Matthew chapter 18. Chapter 18, verse 21. Peter comes up to Jesus and asks him, Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? And then he says something he thinks he's going to get Scooby snacks from Jesus. He goes, seven times? Now, in their culture, it was three strikes, you're out policy. You were kind of expected to forgive somebody for the same mistake three times. Fourth time, whatever, you don't have to forgive them anymore. So Peter's trying to act spiritual. I'll double it and add one, because I'm Peter, and I'm just cool that way. And he gets a response he didn't expect from Jesus. He goes, no, not seven times. He replied, but 70 times seven. That's another cultural thing, to do 70 times seven. He didn't mean 490 times. He didn't mean you go make a tally board and go, hey, that's number 489. You got one more, and then you're in for it, buddy. You know, it's not what he's saying. It meant infinitely. You need to always be willing to let things go. But like I said, not in a codependent way. You can have boundaries. You can say, we got to rebuild trust. I love you. I forgive you. I just don't trust you. That's going to take time. But the idea was, anytime someone's offended, you got to be willing to let it go every time. And then he explains why. He gives them a parable. And he says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to the king who decided to bring his accounts up to date with his servants who had borrowed money from him. So the king is God. In the process, one of his debtors was brought in who owed him millions of dollars in an unrepayable debt. He couldn't pay, so his master ordered that he be sold along with his wife, his children, and everything he owned to pay the debt. That's every one of us. Did you realize every one of us has sinned against a perfectly righteous God, and we owe a debt to him we can never repay ourselves? You can never be good enough to earn God's love. You can never be good enough where God owes you his love. That is every one of us in this room has an unrepayable debt to God. And here's what God does. The man fell down before his master and begged him, please be patient with me, and I will pay it all. See, blessed are those who are spiritually poor. They realize they're bankrupt. He goes, I can't do it. And then his master was filled with pity for him. Here's the mercy. Pity for the guy who's actually done a wrong against the master. And he says, and he released him and forgave his debt. Not only did he let him go, he didn't just give him more time. He didn't say, work harder. He said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. That's what Jesus did for you and me. And he's trying to describe, because of that, we should be people that can go into our own lives and display that same kind of mercy. But no, we do what this guy does. But when the man left the king, he went to a fellow servant who owed him a few thousand dollars. He grabbed him by the throat and demanded instant payment. So this guy owed a very repayable debt, something the guy could probably pay back in, you know, 6 months or something. And he says, nope. He wouldn't wait. He had the man arrested and put in prison until the debt could be paid in full. So he was forgiven an unrepayable debt and then went and threw another guy in the prison that he avoided over a very repayable debt. When some of the other servants saw this, they were very upset. They went to the king and told him everything that happened. Then the king called in the man he had forgiven and said, you evil servant, I forgave you the tremendous debt because you pleaded with me. Shouldn't you have mercy on your fellow servant, just as I had mercy on you? And here is two of the scariest verses in the Bible. Then the angry king sent the man to prison to be tortured until he had paid his entire debt. That's what my heavenly Father will do to you if you refuse to forgive your brothers and sisters from the heart. Is he saying that if I've accepted the love and forgiveness of Christ, and then I don't forgive others, that I'm going to hell? No. What he's saying, because it's a parable. You don't read it, you go, what is he really trying to say? He's saying this man had escaped prison and a torturing hell, but then put himself back in one when he wouldn't forgive. What this parable is saying is, I experience the freedom of God's forgiveness as I give the freedom of my forgiveness to others. When I'm willing to let go of things, I can experience the joy and the power of Jesus' forgiveness when I let it go. It's because I've been forgiven, I can forgive. And what it's really saying is, if I'm unforgiving, I will become like the unforgiven. Meaning, I will put myself back in the cell that Jesus already took me out of, and I will torture myself the rest of my life. I will have a tortured existence. And many of us are sitting here going, I've given my life to Christ. I do all the things. I go to church. I give. I serve. And why do my relationships matter? Why am I so hurt? Why am I bothered? Why do I still have all these addictions? Why do I have all these hurts, happens, hangers? Why can't I get past these things? Why does God not seem to be helping me? And the reality is, the very strong reality is, many of you are sitting there because you're in a prison you placed yourself in because you're holding on to a hurt and you refuse to forgive and let it go because you think you're letting them get away from it, with it. And you've got to let go, not so they can get away with it, is so you can get away from it. You got to be able to move past it. And it's ripping you up. My precious. That's what he's saying. And you know what? I can tell you this flat out. I started off, the first part of my story was telling you about my struggle with lust. That was the symptom, not the problem. Do you realize years later, as I was in a group, I was meeting with Gary Norton, my mentor. We were on this process, this journey, and I started to put all these steps into place. And then you know, I was having some victory in my life, and I knew that what I wrestled with, but I didn't really know the root of it. What really causes me to run to these unhealthy places? I never really narrowed it down. And as I started to narrow it down, I realized I was about to teach a series related to this. And so I had a friend who had been through the CR series. And in there, they have these things called step studies where they take every one of these choices out of the Beatitudes. And it's this intense Bible study, kind of share time. It's way deeper. And I said, I want to go through that. And you know why I wanted to go through it? Because we were about to launch something like that. And I said, I want to go through it because I want to understand what it's going to be like so I can counsel the people that are on that side of the line. Remember my line? I said, there's messed up. We all have problems, but now this is really messed up. See, I felt I was over here, and all the other people that have shared in the weeks before me, you know, the Bohannans, the Sherwood, they were the people that were over here. I was over here. Might have been close to the line, but they're here, I'm here. And many of you are sitting there thinking through this whole series, I get what he's saying, but I can manage my life. No, you can't, because I is you. All right? I was the guy that thought I was here. I had actually had victory. I was doing the right things, and I thought I had it all figured out, right? I'm just doing the only thing I promised my friend, because I had a personal sponsor, say, I'll take you through, but you have to take it serious. I said, okay, I don't think I really need this, but I will do every step the right way. And I put in the time, took a whole year, went through it. And in one of the steps, you get to this point where you've taken moral inventory, and you have to look at your relationships and evaluate, and list, is there anyone you've hurt, or anyone that's hurt you, and you need to let go of it. And I figured, you know, I'm pretty good. I've shaken the dust off my feet from people before. So I said, no, I'm fine. He goes, are you sure? I go, yes, I've dealt with it. I do the right thing. I do the right thing. I'm the guy that does the right thing. I was the good son. My sister was the spaz. I'm the youth pastor. I was the leader of the baseball team. I was the guy that got the straight A's. I'm the good boy. So no, I deal with stuff. And then that week I couldn't sleep, and one night I woke up and had a dream, and I realized that wasn't a dream. That was a memory of something I had forgotten about, and I wanted to forget about it. And I remembered the church I came from to plant this church, the senior pastor, I got along fine. He's a great man, good guy. But, you know, he didn't understand church planting, and in the process of getting to leave, he kind of did some very hurtful things to me. And as far as up to me, I try to have peace. We try to go in. And he kept saying, you know, he would start to act like, okay, but he wouldn't own something. And he refused to really make peace unless I would admit that I'd gone around him and tried to talk to people and rally support to go plant this church without his blessing. And I didn't do that. So I said, no, I can't go there. I want to make peace with you, but I'm not going to lie. And I threw myself on my sword for that. And then, you know the memory I remembered? There was one person I did talk to. One person. Now listen to me. This does not sound as extreme as the lust issue. But what I'm about to tell you is the root of the lust issue. It took me 5 years to figure this out. So I remember the one thing. And I wanted to justify it. It was a silly conversation with someone I knew much longer than him. It didn't go anywhere. I wasn't trying to do anything with it. But every time I tried to justify that and forget about it, I realized, but I did talk to someone when I swore to him I didn't. So I went back and I told my sponsor. There's just one incident. He goes, what do you think about it? I go, well, I just can't let go of it. I don't know why God revealed it to me. It's not like I had a voodoo doll of this guy. I wasn't going, it's not like when I saw him on the internet, I'd be like, anything going on, I go, I hate that guy. Occasionally when I was describing what happened, and I was saying, well, how he got out here and how he kind of acted, my voice would get up and I'd get a little bit ragey inside. But then I catch myself because I do the right thing. I say, you know what, he's a good guy. He hurt me, but he's a good guy, and I'd quickly retreat from the, because I did the right thing. And he goes, well, what do you think you should do? I go, I think I need to own this. I don't want to call him, and so I decided I wanted to send him an email. I'm going to send you an email and say, hey, by the way, I did talk to one person. And in my mind, I thought, it was no big deal, it was just this, whatever, get over it. You know, but then I said, no, I got to own it. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to say it to him. And I go, and my sponsor goes, why? What's the big deal about saying, you know, 7 years ago, however many years, I talked to one person and I'm sorry. And as I wrestled with not one, I realized I didn't want to say I'm sorry because I was giving away the high ground and I knew that I was going to have to set down my precious. And I realized that the way he hurt me altered the way I viewed people. It altered the way I trusted people in my life. I started to change the way I trusted people in authority over me and people that came alongside me. I realized that it had subtly made me wait for people that I thought were on my side to turn on me. So subtle. I never thought about it. I just did. I became more protective. I wanted to keep my precious. I knew that if I said I'm sorry, I was going to have to forgive him completely. So I talked to my friend about it. I said, well, I think I'm going to do it. He goes, well, let me ask you another question that's going to make you dig in. What are you going to do if he doesn't respond? I'm like, what does that mean? I go, think about it. What if you write him and you share this and he never writes you back? What if he doesn't respond? How are you going to react? He said, I'll be good. I'm just, you know, I'm trying to just set it on the table and walk away, right? And then I go, you know what? Nope. I'm going to be mad. I just realized I think I'll be hurt because he did way more things to me than I did to him. So if I finally share the one thing, shouldn't he repent? Shouldn't he come back to the table? Shouldn't he confess? Shouldn't he reconcile with me? And he goes, then don't send it. Because this is supposed to be about you making amends, you getting past. Who cares? And you can't send it till you're ready. And he's like, stupid study. This is a dumb thing, guys. It was not something that consumed my life physically and on the conscious level. But as I revealed that, I go, well, then why don't I just do this? So I finally had to say, God, I'm letting this go. And I'm going to say I'm sorry. And then in my heart, I'm forgiving him. And then as I wrote, I started off, I was just going to write, I just wanted you to know I had this conversation, I'm so sorry. And right after I said I'm so sorry, something, a weight came up. And I didn't feel stressed. I felt a relief. And I kept typing. And I wrote more. And I said, and you know what? I know that some weird things happened. And I know I'm at fault in a lot of them too. And I just want, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. And the things that I think that you hurt me, I just have completely forgiven you. And I'm letting it go. And by the way, and I went on for another paragraph letting him know about a lot of things that he actually did for me that I had suppressed and never thought about. And they just came out. Like, he's the one that taught me how to be a better leader. He taught me to want to learn leadership. He made me read a book that I have everyone that comes on our staff and our elder board read. It was this book that just opened up my eyes to, I could teach, I could preach, but it showed me what leadership was from a biblical point of view. And he inspired me to do that. He did a lot of good things. He's the one that my family could never have a house. He went to bat and got the church to give me a down payment for that. He did, all these things started flooding back. And even though he did hurt me, I was free to thank him for those things and say I'm sorry. And I sat it at the table, I unhooked the leash, and I walked away. He never wrote me back. And it doesn't bother me. I don't know what his journey entails. I just know that I'm okay. But you know what I learned in that process? I'll share more about this. Got to shut it off here, but I run to my unhealthy place like lust. And one of the number one things that drives me there is stress. And the number one stress in my life is the fear of not succeeding. And the number one fear I have is when people hurt me, I wait for the shoe to fall, and I feel like I have poured so much into them. And then they turn on me. And that breaks my heart, stresses me out. I don't know what to do to it and with it. And I want to run to someplace unhealthy. And to be a person that wants to make people happy and then give so much of your heart for them and then have them walk away from you and you not understand and get bitterly hurt is the worst thing possible for a pastor who preaches to have. Because you don't know my heart. I know that I honestly stand up here and want the best for you that God wants. I am not trying to manipulate you. You have no idea. You just have to choose to believe me on that. And I know that just like Jesus, the more he spoke the truth, he had people walk away from him. And that rips me up and stresses me out if I don't handle it the right way. I either want to cave and codepend and go, no, come back. We'll do what you want, which I'm just too stubborn to do that. Or I get bitter and get mad and I want to stress. It eats me alive. And can I tell you something? That is the much bigger issue than what I look at on a computer. What I look at on a computer is the natural byproduct of running to a place where I have to be the good guy that does the right thing no matter how I feel. And I have to look at people that come to me and ask for spiritual counsel after I know they already left the church. So they just got 2 hours of counsel out of me when they walked away. And I want to be mad. I want to be hurt. I want to be upset. Or I can say I can be Jesus for this person and not care where they go to church. And just say I love them and I hope that Jesus gets through to them. And I don't know what's going on in their life. I have no idea what the future holds. I'm just going to be Jesus in this moment. But I want to be hurt and I don't. And when I think the wrong way, I get stressed about it. It stresses me out and I want to run to a safe place where I don't have to be the right guy. I don't have to do the right thing. I don't have to carry that pressure. I don't have to do it. I can just be me, do whatever I want, be all by myself and be left alone. Yeah. Porn's not a problem. It's the result of a problem. And that's why you got to let things go. Because if I didn't learn to do this, and it's not a one and done, I always struggle with it. Every time, I can feel the stress rising. And that's the journey of recovery. It's to learn to spot those warning signals and learn to go, man, where's this fear coming from? You know who I need to run to? The pure, merciful peacemaker who loves me so much. And I need to be that. in my life? That's the challenge. That's why there's those cards. And I just want to close up and give us a chance to do something about it right now. Band's going to come out. They're going to sing a song. No words. This is a song that you just listen to. It's called Forgiveness. And what I want us to do is have a chance that while they're singing this song, you can take this card out, because this is how you deal with it. You take it to the cross and you cross it out. And it may seem silly, but I'm going to challenge you to physically write down, I need to ask for forgiveness for, whatever you want to write. And then if there is someone you need to offer forgiveness to, this might be as far as it goes. You might never have to contact the person, because it's about you. But let it go. Some of you people that are in the grave are still controlling your life. Let it go. Let the weight be lifted. Cross it out. So while they sing, just there's pens in the back of the chairs. Just think about it. And just do it. And if you refuse to do it, ask yourself, why? If I've been forgiven so much, because you realize Jesus will never ask you to forgive more than you've been forgiven. There is nobody you need to forgive that what you need to forgive them for is more than what Jesus forgave for your whole life. Just have some faith and trust him. Take these few moments and do that.